everyone, welcome to This Is Whole Life. Every single week, we come because we love you, and we want to talk over the things that are happening here at Whole Life Church in Orlando, Florida. And as always, Ken Wetmore to my right, lead pastor. And I asked you last week what you did, and someone came up to me and they said, how in the world did you forget what Melanie does? And I said, well, I just did. She's our worship pastor. This is the communication director, Lucas, and I'm Randy, and we are here every week to, like I said, continue to discuss the topics that we are talking about here at Whole Life Church. And it would be really super cool if we had your voice as part of the conversation. 407-965-1607 will get you a voicemail or text, and podcast at wholelife.church. Super easy. And this week we were in Ruth
for
a couple of minutes.
The penultimate chapter.
The penultimate.
Yes, yes.
Because
it was a brief stop in Ruth after a really rewarding trip through Deuteronomy. And so I was
the week before.
Well, this week was Deuteronomy, wasn't it? 25?
I think maybe that's the first time anyone in history has ever said a rewarding trip through Deuteronomy.
Well, I mean, we learned what levirate marriage was, right? I mean,
this is true.
I see. Yeah, so you're talking about this week. Yeah. There you go.
Yep. So anyway.
I'm sorry. I thought you were referencing back to last week when we did a whole.
No, I feel like this is the standard now. You set the standard.
Oh, just detour a little bit?
For the detour. And I hope that. I hope it's on tap for this week for another little detour.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to go back to Genesis and read the story of Tamar.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yes.
It would make sense.
Yeah, I'm just saying that not and then maybe this is a tip to Melanie. Maybe this is subconscious. I don't know, like not tipping your hand to what's going to be talked about completely because we're starting off in places that
– I actually tend to think we'll probably jump ahead this next week. I don't think we'll go backwards.
Oh, jump ahead this week. I'm excited now.
Well, for the record, I was kidding about Tamar, so.
Oh, well, maybe, too late now.
You've already played
with the scene. You put that little brain worm in and I will figure it out. Don't worry.
Man, so
– I will go online and see what I can find to
see what I can. So, you know, I mean, we have good suggestions here. So again, you know, use those aforementioned contact routes to get your voice heard, and who knows, maybe Ken will go forward or backwards or go sideways and find
Please
something.
Please don't go sideways.
Things often go sideways. That's fair.
You just never know.
And sometimes they even show up on Instagram.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. That was awesome.
You're famous. Yeah. What was the
pastors with props Instagram. Props. Yeah. Hey, whoever you are out there, I know you're listening. I'd have almost zero doubt that whoever submitted that clip,
it wasn't me for director.
Is maybe like even in the room, but no. Perhaps on staff. Who knows? I think Carla. Anyway,
you think?
I don't know. Who knows? But anyway, whoever you are, that was kind of fun, actually. So basically, there's an Instagram account that that collects, aggregates pastors using props in sermons, and somebody turned me in for the first sermon of this year, where we had the water hose.
The garden hose. Yeah.
And I have to say the comments part of it is the absolute best part of it because I think so far there's, I don't know what it's at, like over 10,000 views of this thing on that particular Instagram account. And my favorite was, because if you don't remember this sermon, this is the sermon where I brought the garden hose in and we started filling up cups and all that good stuff. And my favorite comment was the person who wrote, well, he certainly is living up to his name, Ken Wetmore. So I thought that was pretty good. And then my other favorite was the person, the angry individual who said, you just probably found it online and it's a shame he's getting paid. It's like, well, buddy, Don't worry. I'm a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. I'm not getting paid that much. I'm not. You're probably assuming I'm some mega church pastor getting, you know, seven figures.
And you don't get a bonus for the props.
I don't even get into the six figure. Man. So you can rest easy, John, wherever you're at. And my kids both started laughing because they know my daughter's like, I wish she knew how to use the internet.
I know. I was just like, you just got serious cred.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm not saying my sermons are good, but I will say they are original.
And you never know who that's going to resonate with.
I have an aversion to preach. I don't even like to preach my own sermons twice. So preaching someone else's is anathema to me. So yeah. I think the closest I've gotten to it is I just absolutely loved Tim Keller's book, The Prodigal God. And that is probably about the closest I've come to copying anything that somebody else. And I definitely try to give credit where credit is due on these things. But I think it's just so much more fun to read the Bible for yourself and come up with your own ideas, whether they're good or not. Just, you know, there you go.
So, it's like the comments section. I mean, you come for the video, but you stay for the comments. That's where the fun is.
So, and the more original, the better. So, great job to whoever's putting together
pastors with props.
That was a great idea. I love it.
There
was something oddly like it was like, you know, my video was like three down from Francis Chan's. I'm like, wow. I mean, that's like,
you're rubbing shoulders and,
not rubbing shoulders, but
three down.
I hope somebody did hashtag this is whole life.
We should. Yeah. If not, someone's got to go back there.
Maybe I'll comment.
I know. How
there
can
you
we?
Go.
The whole idea of
or
Instagram.
Don't.
Not a lot.
You know, whatever.
I don't know if I'm sure. I have a lot of other props. I was actually pretty relieved that was the one they picked.
So. I think it's time to dig back into the Ken archives. I don't know.
I have achieved everything that I want to achieve in life at this point. We're good.
Just leave it. So on today's message, this was week 3 of Ruth, and we have a nervous Ruth, a Ruth in love, a Ruth in loss, a Ruth in shriek on the threshing floor. Well done, Ellie. and portraying Ruth and the shriek got me pretty hard this morning. I was afraid I was waking everybody up in the rest of the house when she did the shriek. But next, do we have someone for next week?
We have two someones.
Oh, yeah. Ruth is back. Yeah. So we'll have all 4 weeks with nice. Good job, drama people.
Yes, good job. And thanks again to Craig for directing.
Nice. No, this
and Tammy for writing.
And Tammy for writing.
These have been fantastic. Yeah. being that it was Mother's Day on Sunday, Ken brought up, what would you be willing to do for your mother-in-law? And I was like, well, obviously questions like this may only be asked in the penultimate message in the series because you can't just slide those in anywhere. And, I kind of like saying penultimate.
Now I see why you
make sure that any chance you get.
Exactly. Well, there's one in every series, so you can go to town on that one.
Yeah. Well, we've only had – no, we had one this year that was only two. That was Live with Purpose and Live
that's
with
Purpose. Still a penultimate.
Still be a penultimate there.
What?
Anything in a series is going to have a penultimate episode, even if it's the first one.
Because it's always the one that precedes the last one.
Yes.
Oh. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Wow. See, we learned something new. This is why we
now
came
I
to gotta
ask you, what did you think it was?
I thought, you said it was the third one. But it was before the end one. So I was like, is that the third? That doesn't make any sense.
No,
but I'm like, whatever.
It is the episode before the final episode or the
penultimate before the ultimate.
Before the ultimate. Yeah. I was like, this is Ken's word. So I didn't look it up.
It can't be that important.
You
can post that one to the Pastors with Words Instagram account.
Oh, man. So the Leverett marriage, I was like, I guess we've probably known this in some way, but this, you know, we took off and defined it. And you think about man marries a woman, they don't have children, man dies, woman marries man's brother or an ex-brother or even, how far down, when they took this all the way to the end, is that correct?
Not necessarily, but if possible, yes. So levirate marriage has an interesting history. And if you go on and actually research it further, there was a lot to it. In fact, as time went by, the rabbis actually began being against levirate marriage. And there was a whole process where you could deny, where you could say, I'm not going to do it. There's a word for that, and I can't remember what the word is. And in fact, today, within Judaism, obviously that is discouraged, and there's a word for it, and there's a process that you go through. But it was a thing, and again, back in that time, that place, if you start thinking about the reasons behind it, there was actually some really good reasons behind doing that. Some reasons that were there for the protection of the woman, the care of the woman, as well as just the continuation of that family line.
Well, it seems weird because if it doesn't seem weird, just if you have siblings and you're a man, and or I guess if you're a woman and like, boy, I really like my spouse, but his brother.
I think you become a little bit more invested in who your siblings marry, right?
Yeah. I think one of the key things is there are a lot of arranged marriages, so it wasn't like you pick the love of your life and then.
Like, man, then I get stuck with this bum.
Okay, I'm in this family now.
Let's keep it in the family.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah.
So that one was like, wow, I can see from my perspective. And then it's like, ooh, I can see it from the other side too. Like, it played an important role that, I mean, maybe when it comes to what I'd rather be with the person that I truly love, or, I mean, eating is cool too. And being taken care of.
But going back to Melanie's point, the idea of marrying for love in that time and place was foreign. People did not get married because they're like, oh, I choose you. It was no, mom and dad chose you, and it was usually going to be for the helping the clan. In some way. Again, we were very individualistic in our thought processes and the culture that we live in here in the United States. But in communal cultures where the community is what's most important and the individual is not what's most important, it really matters that you better your family, that you strengthen clan ties, that you make alliances. And that's how – and you did it through weddings and through marriage. You did it by creating children. You know, it's very hard if there are two tribes and they intermarry, it's harder for the tribes to fight, to go to war against each other because, you know, your daughter is over there. Your grandchildren are over there. And so in a communal culture like that, they weren't interested. You'll figure out how to make it work. And in places today where families actually choose who their children will marry, they have much less of a divorce rate. Some might argue because in those societies, oftentimes if you get divorced, you can also the penalty can be death, and so that could sometimes be a real deterrent to that. But other parts of it that become interesting and thought provoking is that if you're getting married not out of some idea that this is about you and about what's going to be best for you, but what's best for your family, what's best for the community, and it's not. Then maybe you're a little bit less concerned if everything is exactly the way that you thought it should be, and you figure out how to make it work. And so, Kyla and Eric, I have picked people out for you. There is no death penalty if you don't do it. But
do you have any Titus Bill? Do you have any Titus Bill? I mean,
what was it? Oh, Titus Bill?
Yeah, I mean,
no, I don't think so. But I think it probably would not be the right place
because you don't have their permission.
No,
and always
I'm very good about that.
Yeah, that's
very
true.
Good about that.
Good.
Yeah.
All right, I was thinking that was probably the case, but I mean, even worse than all that, death and everything else, you could be, you could be known as, or you could be referred to, or have your your clan be referred to as the family of the man whose sandal was pulled off?
You yeah. could be, yeah.
What? Terrible. And,
come on now.
Yeah.
Disgraceful.
So
talk about uncovered feet. I mean,
that's right. Right? I mean, is this a – so if the man declines the invitation – you know, she can confront him in the presence of the elders, pull a sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and declare this is what happens to a man who refuses to provide his brother with children. And then ever afterwards, your family is known throughout Israel as the family of the man whose sandal was pulled off. This, I don't remember ever reading this before. Because it's...
Well, you hadn't taken that... You know, that brilliant and satisfying journey through Deuteronomy all the way, I guess. Yeah.
Or I was just like, I was just reading really fast. I just need to get through this so I can say it's done. But that is absolute gold. But why? Like, what's the sandal have to do with anything? I mean, is it what's it symbolic of that there's, I mean, someone who's not poor or someone who's able to take, you know, if you're wealthy enough to have sandals, you should be – it's your duty then to take care of?
I don't know.
I'm wondering.
But we do have – I mean, John the Baptist talked about, you know, not being worthy to untie Jesus' sandals. So I don't know.
Maybe we'll look that up and talk about it a little bit more this next week because a sandal is about to be removed in Ruth chapter 4.
Oh, there's another sandal. The other shoe's going to drop?
Oh. Well played, sir. Well okay. played.
All right. Well, and I just thought that was funny that I was like, wow, really? This sandal? And I mean, obviously, your mode of transportation by far was probably most popular was by foot. So, I mean, I get that sandals were important, but that just seemed odd that, oh, yeah, I'll call you a name. You family of the man whose sandal was pulled off. I'll show you. You know, and it's like, well, that took a long time, and I'm not even mad anymore. I don't know. It seemed really, really weird. But so through the whole chapter, because as Ken's getting to the end, I'm like, okay, he's running out of time, and I haven't this is all super interesting. There's you know, the sandals. There's the you know, thinking about Naomi and Ruth having to have this conversation about, you know, laying out the plan, as it were. And I don't know, that would be a tough, I mean, I don't think it matters that it's two women. I mean, would that be a conversation that you'd want to have with your father-in-law if it was the other way around or a mother-in-law? It's just like, that is just a wild conversation to have to go into. And then to really think about, Is this going to work? Is he – I mean, it seems like Naomi was pretty confident that this was going to work. But I read it again this morning. I just read through. And it doesn't really seem – I mean, I'm sure Ruth is like, okay, if you say this is what we're supposed to do, I guess this is it. But it doesn't feel like Ruth is like, all right, let's go get this done and, you know, this will all be good and everything will be – you know, good from here on out. It seems like that's a pretty, from what's being asked of her and not being her culture, this just seems weird.
Well, this is a little more than asking someone to prom, but, you know, think right. about how stressful it is when you're a teenager thinking about who's going to ask who to prom or something like that. This is that like times 1,000.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And especially when your whole existence other than, you know, like, hey, we can't just sit here and count on somebody's good graces as, you know, picking up the, you know, behind everybody at the harvest who this isn't a way to sustain one's life.
Well, think about the power dynamic.
Yeah.
The power dynamic, it is completely shifted onto to Boaz. And so when you are completely powerless and you're completely dependent on someone else's, you know, benevolence – that's really tough.
And this is not, I think we also need to acknowledge that as much as we've talked about how things are different in that time and that place, this was still very unorthodox
in that
time and that place. What she was doing was way, way out of line for the customs and standards of the time. It was something that was very risque, very just – it definitely had a high chance of really going wrong, and so you know, she was a very brave person. And it's interesting in the two books in the Old Testament that are named after women, Ruth and Esther, both of them have to do stuff that puts them in harm's way in serious ways. And they both show extreme bravery, whether that's Esther going in before the king uninvited, with the potential that if he doesn't greet her, that she could be executed, to Ruth going on to the—I mean, there was so much danger involved in this. It was the threshing floor, as the script talked about, as Ellie talked about, portraying Ruth. The threshing floor was a very dangerous place for women to be. That was not a, like, oh, let's just go hang out here late at night. It was dangerous. For her to go up to Boaz put her in an incredibly compromising position. It was, and as I mentioned in the sermon, theologians do battle on whether or not exactly what it meant to uncover Boaz's feet.
Yeah.
For some theologians, they believe there was a sexual act that took place there. And they believe that because there are other places in the Bible where it talks about uncovering somebody's feet is a sexual act. It's a euphemism for that, and it's very clear in some other places in the Bible that that's it. Another side of theologians, which I think official Seventh-day Adventist theology is that there wasn't a sexual act involved, that it just genuinely was that she went and you know, laid down at his feet, and then he noticed her. And the reasoning on that is that he says she's a virtuous woman. And I think that part of it also is we don't know, but I think that we tend to also want to view that through the lens of what's normal and what would, you know, the sexual mores of our time. And so most people are like, well, a good person wouldn't go have a sexual act. I mean, you wouldn't do that if you're a virtuous woman. And again, the theologians on the other side who say, no, there's something happened, said, well, you're taking that through your lens right now. What in her time and her place, maybe that was going to be a little not acceptable, but it was going to be a way of saying to Boaz, okay, you need to do something, Buster. You need to go ahead. We've done something now. You need to go ahead and make this legitimate. And so whichever way you want to view it, I think I tend to land, which I don't know, it's just, you know, my American ways, I tend to land on the other side of it. There may be other theologians around us that see it a little bit differently.
But that seems like on one hand, you're almost offering yourself, on the one hand, you're putting yourself out there, but you're leaving most of the responsibility. I mean, you're still putting the ball's still in Boaz's court either way. But it seems like if there's an actual sexual act, then it seems a little bit more like the way you just said it, like, all right, you know, we've done something now and, you know, it's up to you to make it right. That seems like it's a little bit more, I don't know, just it seems out of character for Ruth for me. But not to say that means anything. It just,
yeah, and I don't know. Like I said, for me, it seems a little hard to think that Boaz would not have been aware, you know, that – I don't know. Anyway, so the whole thing for me – but Melanie, you can talk about this because I read it briefly, but I think you've studied a little bit further that, again, some theologians actually think that when he startled awake, he thought that there was – something else. There's something else. So why don't you share a little bit about that? Because I think you're a little more versed on that than I am.
Yeah, there was during that time there was a belief, and I don't know if it was this kind of legend or what exactly how it came about, but there was a fear of the demon Lilith showing up in the middle of the night to steal a man's seed, and so at least one of the commentaries that I've read. Says that it's possible that when he startled awake in the middle of the night, he thought that was his immediate thought, you know, oh no.
The demon was getting him.
Yeah. Right.
Wow.
What a way to wake up. So that would definitely create more than just startled awake. That would have been, you know, that would have, I mean, genuinely startled awake.
Hmm.
And it is an interesting thing, though, that that Boaz could have sent her away right away. He could have said, okay, I'll do what you're asking. Please, now please leave. But he actually has her stay with him the rest of the evening. He says, you know, just before it gets light, go ahead and go home. And that is an interesting other aspect of this. I think on one way that I would rationalize it, of course, it would have been really dangerous for him to say, leave right now and head home right. in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Who knows, you know, the danger she would have faced, not just from human beings, but wild animals and that sort of thing. So having her stay with him through the end of the night, you know, was in her best interest and her protection. And yet he did have her stay with him for the rest of the evening and stay there. And I think that that's worth noting as well.
Nice. I think they were probably reading the Torah.
Well, I mean, you know, because they candlelight. Have candlelight. And, yeah, I'm sure that's – I mean, everybody brings their scroll with them to
the threshing floor.
To the threshing floor, I'm sure. So, yeah.
And why the threshing floor? I mean, is that just because this is the location where everything has happened? It's the end of the harvest, and they were there to protect the harvest until it was distributed, correct?
Yeah, it was about opportunity.
Okay.
You know, it probably – it was probably a lot easier to find Boaz on the threshing floor than try to wander through his house late at night looking for him. So it was about opportunity. This was a time where Naomi, by the way, Naomi's plan, not Ruth's.
Right.
And this is where Naomi knew that he would be accessible, that if she paid attention, that if Ruth was paying attention, she'd know where he was at, and she could get his attention in a and in a private way make the ask. And that was the other part of it, is that if as long as Boaz didn't start yelling and asking and saying, hey, this woman's an awful person.
Yeah.
She's come to me. And as long as he didn't do that, Ruth's exposure would be limited. In other words, she did it late at night. If people didn't notice, then basically everything would be, you know, her reputation would remain intact.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, she was a widow too. So this isn't, you know, this isn't some young woman who hasn't had sexual relations before. This is a widow. And she's coming to Boaz and saying, hey, look, I not only need a husband, I need somebody to take care of my mother-in-law.
Well, yeah.
And it was really embarrassing. It should have been embarrassing to the people of Bethlehem that nobody had stepped up to this point to do what was being done. And the reason Boaz probably hadn't was because he knew there was somebody else in line, and he was waiting for that person to take care of their responsibility. And in some ways, I think Ruth was somewhat shaming Boaz because their culture was an honor and shame culture. In other words, you have a bank account. And when you do virtuous things, it adds to the honor of your family and your family's reputation. When you do shameful things, it takes money out of that bank account. And in your bank account, your honor shame bank account was actually more important than your financial bank account.
Hmm. Wow.
And so I think Ruth was saying to Boaz, look, there is another person who's in line, but why haven't you gone and pressured him to take care of Naomi and I, to fulfill the obligations of a kinsman redeemer, which is to say to, hey, Naomi, you're in a horrible spot here. Let us go ahead and help take care of you. But they hadn't done that. And Boaz had been generous. He'd been overly generous.
Sure.
And he'd gone up. But there was more that he could do. And Ruth and Naomi are pointing this out to him. Hey, you can go and ask the other person to fulfill their responsibility. You can push them to do that. And we prefer you, but if you're not going, but you're going to need to do this, because the women didn't have the standing to go to the gate and say, hey, take care of us, do the right thing. And so I think there's a little bit of that going on as well.
And what better way to make that logical argument than to show up in the middle of the night in the bed of a man who's been eating, drinking? I think that was a great plan.
It was. It worked out. It did.
You
can't argue with that.
If you're going to make a plan.
And Boaz, I have to say, seems very enthusiastic. Naomi's Naomi's closing comment, I thought, said it all. He will not rest until he has settled this matter.
The sun will not set until this is
handled. I'm like, you know, here we got levirate marriage. You've got my daughter, my potential wife. I mean, this all, you know, pressure, no pressure, feet, no feet. Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days, days of our lives.
Oh, wait a minute.
I was like, this seemed a little. It seemed like we veered a little bit into, you know, the soap opera world just for a moment or two, but sometimes that's the way things have to get done, right? You know, like you said, if they're not going to pressure the person ahead of you in line, even though you're willing, then you're not being very helpful to us at all. Because do we know how long it was? That was the other question. That they were back from their journey back to their from when this starts to when Ruth and Boaz are together.
Do we have any idea? I don't know, but it seems like it was only one season.
Like it doesn't seem like it went. Yeah,
it doesn't seem like it went on for years.
So, but I mean, it probably still felt long enough after the, you know, the whole thing, and then you're stuck in limbo. Until somebody decides
to push it forward.
So then I was thinking about when Ellie first is talking about this, like, wow, this plan, they've got to put it together. And then afterwards, as Ken, I think you said, Naomi's like, she knew her guy and knew this was going to be good. But then I'm thinking about, I don't also want to have the details conversation with you either. So I don't think I wanted to have the planning phase conversation. So how'd it go? That's none of your business.
It worked the way you said it would.
That's it. Moving on. But through all of this, you know, the idea that Ruth, like, just doesn't lose faith, doesn't get down, or maybe she does and we just don't know about it, but... Like how she goes through this part of all these different hoops that they're having to go through, and we have plans, we have, you know, and we don't know if it's going to work, we don't know if we're going to be shunned, we don't know any of this, and then just like keeping Naomi in the front of her, you know, like I'm doing this, I'm assuming, it seems like. That she's doing this because obviously she needs help, but also it seems like Naomi is the real push behind it. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I don't think that's something that Ruth probably would have thought of to do on her own. But you know what? When you are in a serious time of desperation.
Maybe. Well, yeah.
And keep in mind, like we talked in the first week about who's writing this story and for what purpose. And I think it's very interesting that when they write this story that it is Naomi's idea to do this. They don't put it on Ruth.
Well, she couldn't be the virtuous woman probably.
Right. And so...
So Naomi is not the virtuous woman because it's her plan?
Well, she is. She's an Israelite. Mm-hmm. And she has the status to be able to get away with it. And not only get away with it, but they can make the argument that it made sense. And so I think... And again, I don't doubt that Naomi actually did come up with that. It really makes complete sense. It doesn't make sense that Ruth, the foreigner, would have understood all the nuances of the culture and been able to navigate all that. So it makes complete sense that Naomi came up with it, but the person writing it didn't have to say that. One of the things that you very much know as a journalist is that what you include and what you don't include can completely shape the story the way that you want it to be. You can tell a true story, but not tell the truth. You can frame a story in a way that slants things. And that's, I think, one of the things that people misunderstand about the news is like, oh, they're dishonest. Well, maybe. But it's also about the details you include, and it's usually that journalists aren't flat out lying, that it's just they're choosing which details to include and which ones not to include. And in this particular case, the person telling the story could have said, this is what Ruth did. They didn't have to say Naomi and she sat down and had this conversation. Naomi said, my daughter, go do this. They could have just said, in the fullness of time, Ruth decided, Ruth received advice. They didn't have to say it. They could have said any number. There's a lot of different ways to write this story. But I think that they went out of their way to help frame Ruth in the most positive light possible, to give the reader that they wanted to be sympathetic to who Ruth was and the good woman that she was. And they wrote it in a way that framed her in the best light that they could find.
And yet there is potential symbolism in the fact that she left with an apron full of grain, which grain is seed. And if you think about carrying an apron full of seed and what that silhouette would look like, it might look like someone who was pregnant.
Yeah.
So it depends on how far you want to read into the details that were included in the story.
Days of Our Lives, huh?
That's right.
There's a lot there.
I like it.
It's a lot to think about.
The fun part, though, is, I mean, Naomi kind of, I don't know, ends this chapter as the wise old, woman who everything she planned, everything that she put in motion and helped with, it's really on one hand, you're like, okay, there's a little bit of Naomi, the shyster that might be just like, I know the rules. I know how this works, but all right, if no one's going to do it, I got a plan. We're going to put this in motion. We're going to make this move forward. And I just really thought, I've never seen Naomi that way before. And to me, it was very, very entertaining to see that. And for her to be like controlling or steering, maybe not controlling, but maybe steering this whole thing from the background, and just watching Ruth, it had to be interesting for her to even though they knew each other very well, like you said, Ruth not being versed in this process, and like, what am I doing? What is this anyway? And what kind of God are we serving that this is the route we're taking? But I just thought I have a new respect for Naomi, and it's seems like a lot of fun.
When you don't have power, you have to do some unconventional things.
There you go. Lucas, do we have any questions?
Yeah, I got two here.
Excellent.
So I got one from Aaron. Curious. Dr. Gottman talked about beat attempts. Was what Ruth looked like one of those for her culture?
Can you say that again, Lucas?
Yeah. Dr. Gottman talked about beat attempts. Was what Ruth looked like one of those for her culture?
What's it? I'm not sure what a beat attempt is.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that. Sounds interesting, though.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar. Aaron, that's an interesting. You're asking a question that makes me curious, because I'm not familiar with Dr. Gottman talking about that. I haven't read extensively Dr. Gottman's work, so I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to expound on that, Aaron, send it back next week, and we'll come back to it. You can either send it to podcast@wholelife.church or just 407-965-1607, and we'll see if we can get some background and see how that might fit in.
A bid is any attempt from one partner to another for attention, affirmation, affection, or any other positive connection.
Yeah, we're all looking this up really quick to see if we can get the give you an answer.
Was it an attempt to get attention?
In the healthiest relationships, both partners are comfortable making all kinds of bids.
So Aaron, having just Googled this and now just becoming minimally familiar with it, I would say that there may be some of that, but I think the big difference is that at this point, this isn't a stable relationship. This isn't two people who are dating. This isn't two people who are married. This is a person who, Ruth, who is approaching another person, Boaz, who Boaz hasn't even really considered her as a potential spouse. And so, in one sense, is it a verbal, nonverbal attempt to connect? Well, yes, but this is outside of any kind of relationship. So I would say it's a little bit different. But then that's just me with about 30 seconds of research. So But interesting, very interesting. And good for you, by the way. For those of you who aren't familiar with Gottman, just probably one of the preeminent resources in marriage counsel and advice. They're phenomenal. They're so good. Gottman is so highly respected. He's Christian. And the Gottmans are Christian. And outside of Christian circles, their marriage advice is highly highly respected. John Gottman, great stuff. So if you ever have a chance to read anything by John on marriage, just phenomenal, good stuff. So there you go. Thanks for mentioning that. And Aaron, I need to read up a little bit more. I've read a little bit of Gottman's material, but I haven't gone super deep in it.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And the second one is, in Ruth 2:12, Boaz speaks of God's wings as a place of refuge. How does this imagery of God as a protective bird appear elsewhere in Scripture? And how does it deepen our understanding of divine compassion?
It's a pretty frequent metaphor throughout the Old Testament. I believe Isaiah uses it, Jeremiah. And Jesus actually references it when he approaches Jerusalem. He says, "How I've longed to gather you under my wings,"
yeah.
like a mother bird. And so the imagery there for a agrarian society, or in other words, a place that's very close to nature that does a lot of farming, that sort of thing, would have been very poignant, because anybody who's had chickens, if danger starts coming, what happens? The mother chicken gathers her chicks underneath her wings, and it's a place of protection. They gather them in that way. And the same thing is really true for other birds as well. They'll gather their young underneath their wings, and if there is an attack, the mother is going to be attacked first, and will do everything that she can to protect her young. And so the imagery is all throughout the Bible, and it's actually beautiful imagery. And one of the things that you have to know about baby chicks, if you're not familiar, is that they'll run all over the place. They're not always the best behaved. And maybe that's a beautiful metaphor, that we may not be the best behaved, but God still gathers us under his wings and still loves and cares for us.
Well, and think about in Trinitarian theology, one member of the Godhead is often represented as a dove, as a bird. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that metaphor is kind of expanded.
Yeah.
When we think about the Holy Spirit.
Pip, pip, the naughty chicken. Anybody?
Way to go. That's you've been reading books
really
again.
Smooth.
I have. Well, it's books on 45.
Yeah. Well, I forget. Yes, you're right. There we go.
Books on 45. For those of you old enough to know what that means, you'll get it.
Is that Eric B. Hare?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That was
Pip Pip the Naughty Chicken.
That's right.
I'm sure I've mentioned it multiple times because I'm so proud of it. But Eric B. Hare.
Yeah. Baptized you, right?
Dedicated me as a baby.
Dedicated
you.
That's right. Dedicated.
My middle name. I'm named after him, yeah.
Eric?
Yep.
That's your middle name?
Yep.
Oh. Does that mean Eric is named after
your middle name?
Or Eric Behar?
My son is named after me, but I guess you could say
as an extension.
But Eric's a junior without being a junior, because he's Eric Kenneth and I'm Kenneth Eric.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Cool.
Clever.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it's clever, but it's what happened.
That's awesome. Okay, well, so this was the penultimate, which is the episode before the end. So next week we finish up, and in Ruth, all four chapters, 4 weeks.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad. It's only four chapter
really
book.
Yeah.
So what comes after then? We're
Memorial Day,
because it's getting to be we're already the 13th. As we take.
Yeah, so we have Memorial Day. We'll have a special Memorial Day sermon for that. And then Sabbath after that, we have one of our Voices of Whole Life, which we're doing a little bit differently this year. In the past, it's been the entire month of June has been church members doing sermons. And this year, we've decided to try something a little bit different, and we still have four church members speaking, but they're speaking throughout the year, so we're scattering them through the year. And so our speaker coming up in 3 weeks is Amanda Maggart. Amanda's phenomenal. She's been a longtime member here at Whole Life,
yep.
And I know that she's already actually been working on her sermon with Melanie, and Melanie's had a chance to already hear it, and so we're excited for what Amanda's going to be talking about. I think I can tell them, right, that it's what the top
about prayer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
the topic is going to be prayer, so I think that's going to be amazing. And then we're going to jump into our summer series right out of that. I will be doing a series all through the summer on stories about water in the Bible, and we're calling it Water Tales. So
Water Tales.
Wetmore series.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh, man.
I mean, it's supposed to go along with Overflow, but yes, okay.
Well, there's still time. There's still time to make changes to the graphics.
And maybe we could just call it the Wetmore series.
I kind of like it now that we've—
Better than Water Tales, actually.
Now that we've established this as pastors with props.
Well, we're doing kind of in conjunction with our summer party, right?
Yeah, all of our— we have— yeah, thanks for mentioning that. All of our summer events are water themed. So the first event of the summer is a big water— we've got inflatable water things that we're going to have here on our on site. And that's, I believe, on June 1. I think it runs from 6:30 to 8:30. So families, bring your kids. There's some sort of ice cream. I don't want to say ice cream because I think
Italian—
it's
pops.
Yeah, Italian. Yeah, Italian
was that,
ice.
Was that the pops event?
Yeah, I think that we've got that. We've got a bunch of inflatable water toys and things like that. So just bring your kids out. They'll have a blast. For those of you who aren't kids, you can still come and hang out and do all the water stuff. I mean, you can do that.
Sure.
And we'll also be opening up a room in the church to play games. So for those of you who just want to play different games, I don't know what kind of water-related games we'd come up with, but they would have to be board games, so not like get wet.
We'll just set up the fountain.
Yeah,
that will be representative.
We'll figure that out. So we have that. We're a water fight that we'll be doing, and the water fight's going to be more in like a kind of more like a capture the flag. But generally in Capture the Flag, you have—
Seriously?
To— yeah.
That was just deja vu.
Okay.
I knew you were going to say Capture the Flag, but I've not heard you talk about this event at all.
Wow.
So I was like, Capture the Flag. And then you said Capture the Flag. That was wild. Okay.
Sorry. So it's going to be— you'll have water balloons, and that's how you have to tag people who are trying to get the flag. So, yeah. So we have that. Then we're going to have a lake day, ice skating. There's going to be a parents' night out. There's going to be a movie night where we show a movie that's related to water. It's a really— do you remember the name of the movie? It's
Titanic.
No, but good guess.
Almost everybody
that would
dies.
Actually make sense.
And there was room. And there was room. Sorry.
There was room.
There was room on the door.
That was a big door.
There was definitely.
There was room on the door for
Jack.
Have you
seen the engineers who have done like all this?
I'm listening to probably the best podcast I've listened to in a year on Titanic.
Okay.
One of the people that are hosting the show, their great uncle Jimmy was actually on the boat in the lowers feeding the boilers. Yeah. It's a pretty cool perspective. Wow. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
So all those—
not Titanic is basically what it boils down to. Okay.
It's a movie. It's a family-friendly movie that's about a penguin. And it's—
search all
the
penguin movies.
I have not actually watched it, but we have a couple staff members who have, and they say it is just a wonderful movie. So I've looked it up, and it looks like it is going to be
wholelife.church/events.
Yeah.
Because these also might be just a little fluid, and I'm not saying like maybe dates or whatever, but—
okay.
But, you know, times could, you know—
times could vary, but we hope we've locked them down at this point. So
but
hopefully
just to
that's
be
the
sure,
case.
Don't show up late for the movie, because if there's one thing, it's like you're halfway down, you're like, oh, man. Oh, yeah. So just pay attention to that. Oh, there's one other thing.
Oh, and let's not forget Vacation Bible School.
That's right.
If you haven't signed up for that, get signed up for that. It's going to be a great one.
We'll make it easy. We'll put it in the show notes and the Discord because child registration is open as well.
It is.
Everything's
open.
And
we also need volunteers. We have a number of high school students who have volunteered, and we appreciate that. We need adults. So if you could do that, that would be fantastic. I think over half of the people who have volunteered are high school students, and we're, again, very grateful for that. And we need adults. So if you are an adult, please sign up to help if you can. It is a morning VBS, and I do know it makes it a little bit more difficult for those who are working. So I understand that. But if you can, sure, appreciate your help. And then, yeah, get your kids signed up. It is, I believe, 4 to going into 4th grade.
Yep, that sounds about right.
Speaking of volunteers, shout out to Karen Causey, who helped me put together 400 Mother's Day gifts this week. Wow.
Extra awesome. Stars in your crown,
yes,
Karen.
Thank you.
And thank you to her husband, who stopped by and talked to us about the podcast last Wednesday out on the sidewalk. And so thank you for sharing, because it makes a difference when you share it with other people that this might be their only connection to Whole Life and maybe to Jesus to get started. So thank you for that, because we do see in the numbers when you guys start listening and sharing. And so thank you for all that. So until next week, where we wrap it all up and really head to summer. Forget it. It's raining every day now. It's over. Mm-hmm. The good times. Not to be back until November. Sorry. Wetmore. It's going to be a Wetmore summer. Oh, my goodness. And with that, thank you all for listening, and have a great week.